This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, I'm Linda Mottram and welcome to Saturday AM. Thank you for joining us. This morning, will COVID-19 reshape Australia's relationship with China?
It's not just a health crisis, this is a political crisis. So it's not possible that it could be the same as before. Everything's going to change.
And the fight over how to reopen the US economy intensifies.
At this time, with just so many Americans unemployed, with the food lines getting longer and longer, and just desperation on the streets. I mean, I feel it here in Washington, D.C., among the homeless. It's getting more and more desperate, the feeling.
But first this morning, you'll have heard this week about negative oil prices.
Never seen anything like it. The price of oil went to zero and then kept on falling.
At the closing bell of the New York Stock Exchange, the coronavirus had taken another toll.
The price settled at, get this, negative $37 per barrel, which is down 305%, meaning people would pay you today to take their oil off their hands.
Quite a moment. But what does it signify for the oil industry, medium and long term, and for you at the Bowser? Well, Associate Professor David Byrne is an energy expert from Melbourne University, and Christian Downey is a research fellow at the Australian National University. Christian, David, thank you both very much for joining us. I'll start with you, Christian, and can we go back to the basics? What happened this week? How does the oil price go into negative territory?
Well, it was kind of an amazing result, and it's the first time it's happened. But if from an economic perspective, it's quite simple. Supply of oil has basically outstripped demand, and prices have fallen accordingly. So as COVID-19 has brought the global economy to a standstill, and you've got planes sitting on runways and cars idle in the garage, demand for oil has plunged, and then prices have plunged as well. And it's not easy for oil producers to simply turn off the tap. They need somewhere to store the oil until they can find a buyer. And so what's happened is, because there's very little storage left, producers this week were literally paying buyers to take the oil off their hands. And that's why we saw the negative prices that we did.
And David, what's your reaction to what we've seen this week? Is it a significant moment for the industry or just a blip?
Yeah, I think it's quite significant. I mean, it's an unprecedented demand shock. We literally don't have the capacity worldwide to take the oil. So there's tankers floating around with oil in places that we can't store it. So it's precedent setting. It is something we rarely see in financial or any kind of economic market. And I think a big thing is oil markets are often the canary in the coal mine for what's about to come in terms of volatility. And this is about as big as we've seen, at least in this market.
We did see it come back up, though, didn't we? But we're not back into sort of normal territory at all.
Not yet. And we will see some rebound in May once the oil production cuts start to kick in that Saudi Arabia and Russia agreed to a few weeks ago. But it takes time for them to adjust their production capacity. And so there should be a bit of a recovery once OPEC and Russia limit their supply a bit.
Christian, just on some more of the practicalities, I mean, we're obviously all driving less. We're flying much less, as you mentioned. There's plenty of oil not being used. So how much can actually be stored? David mentioned their tankers full, and we see the US is reaching peak storage. Are we likely to see more tankers on the sea to store oil?
Well, places like the US have traditionally had large storage. So there's these vast caverns in Louisiana and Texas where most of what's called the US's Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is just a fancy name for its oil stocks, are held. But that's all of that storage, both tankers and in other places like these vast caverns, is quickly filling up. So at the moment, there's very little storage left, and it's obviously not easy to quickly increase storage capacity, which is why we're seeing some of these negative prices and some of the volatility. But as David said, I think prices will rebound a little bit in the coming weeks and months. It's unlikely that we'd see sustained negative prices. Having said that, anyone trying to predict the future of oil prices at the moment is probably a bit of a fool's errand.
Yes, I can well imagine. Christian, I'll just stick with you for a moment. Obviously, production can be slowed down. You've both mentioned that. But can it be stopped?
The short answer is yes, it can be. But it's difficult for oil producers to do it. There's a range of economic and engineering reasons why oil producers don't simply want to shut off their wells. It's not like a tap that you can turn it on and off. If you shut down the well, there's a whole range of economic costs associated with that, and you can't simply just turn it back on. So for some producers, it actually makes sense to keep the well going, even if you're not making a profit, because over the long term, that'll be better for you than turning it on and off all the time.
Now, David, the pricing situation we're seeing at the moment is largely a result of the pandemic, but there are other factors at play. And I think you've both mentioned Russia and the Saudis. They've been in a price war. That's temporarily been resolved. What's going to happen there?
I mean, so predators emerge often in cartels because one of the players in the cartel tries to send a message basically to the others if they don't agree. And you see it in practice when Saudi Arabia floods the market in response to Russia not agreeing to cutting oil supplies a few weeks ago. So, you know, we have two sources of uncertainty going forward on how oil prices are going to fluctuate. One's the COVID-19 demand shock, but the other is trying to predict what OPEC and Russia are going to do in sort of this marriage of suppliers and how they're going to, you know, be responding to each other. That's also a highly uncertain environment on the supply side of the market to be able to, you know, to forecast and try to understand where that's headed.
Now, Donald Trump is keen to protect the US industry, the shale industry. He says he isn't worried about what we've seen this week.
Much of it has to do with short sellers. Much of it has to do, if you look a month into the future, I think it's at $25 or $28 a barrel.
So, Christian, how tricky is this for the US shale industry?
Well, it's very tricky. The US shale industry traditionally has produced oil at a higher cost than other producers such as Saudi Arabia or Russia. And so really low prices, particularly if they're sustained low prices, could mean that a number of shale oil producers in the US might actually have to go to the wall. And so Donald Trump has been quite concerned from his political and economic perspective that these companies don't go bankrupt. And that's why he's keen to see oil prices at a higher level, at a level where these companies can continue to make money and continue to employ people.
And David, it's a global market, obviously. Is there actually much that Trump can do to protect the shale industry in the US and raise the price?
Short of putting tariffs on oil imports into the U.S. to try to fight off Saudi and Russian oil supplies, it's going to be tough for him. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, the cost of producing oil is so much lower than shale production. Basically, if you're further down the food chain, you're the first to get eaten up by an economic crisis like this. So he's got a big task ahead of him, and he's also got to face voters paying higher prices at the pump as a result. So there's a trade-off between protecting jobs, but also taxing people, the Bowser, week to week. So that's a trade-off he's making and trying to work with, which is crazy to say, work with Saudi Arabia and Russia to coordinate on higher oil prices.
What a strange world we live in. David, earlier on you said this is precedent setting. I wonder, you know, will the market bounce back once we're driving again and flying? The developing world uses a lot of oil as well. What do you see with your crystal ball beyond this immediate crisis?
A couple things I wonder about, I guess. So one thing would be in the developing world, I'm not so sure we fully understood in developing countries, especially in Africa, where there's also huge fuel demands, whether that's actually been fully priced in. So we're seeing COVID spread in the developed world. We don't have a good track yet on what's happening around the developing world to forecast future demand. So if that really starts to tank, we could see even further downward pressure on oil prices. In the long run, whenever, you know, we come back to a new normal and planes start flying and cars start driving, they're going to have a huge incentive to, you know, ramp up supply and meet the market. I mean, it can come back relatively quickly when the economy recovers, but that'll be subject also to some of these engineering costs. The companies don't necessarily want to jump right back to full production capacity, but they will be coming back hard, I would suspect, once we're all moving again.
Christian, what do you think the significance of this moment is for the oil industry and I guess the energy industry more broadly?
This could be a predictor of the future to some extent. A lot of people now say that we're reaching peak demand, that demand for oil globally in the coming years will peak and then will decline. And this will essentially create some existential risks for the oil industry because as the world shifts away from oil and gas and coal to deal with climate change and moves to renewable fuels, cars won't be fueled by oil. Everyone will be driving electric cars and so on. And so the future of oil going forward could be in real danger. Now, I'm not saying this is going to happen in the next couple of years. It's not. But peak oil demand is certainly something that's on the horizon and something that might lead to a lot of restructuring in the oil industry over the next decade or so.
And just on the Australian situation, the Australian government has used the cheap oil price as a moment to sort of build this country's stockpile. That seems to be a fairly sensible thing from a national security perspective. What's your take on how they're approaching it and the fact that they're going to store it overseas for a while?
I think it's a good first step. I mean, oil security has been an issue for Australia for some time. We're the only member of the International Energy Agency that doesn't hold 90 days of strategic oil supplies. But the key point here is that the oil at the moment anyway is going to be stored over in the US. The US is not close to Australia. And if there is any supply disruption or a crisis, the agreement is that the US or President Donald Trump would simply agree to send the oil all the way around the world to Australia. And we do know that President Trump doesn't have the best record of keeping his promises. But even if he did agree to send it, it's still going to take about a month to get here. And then there's the question of, do we have the refining capacity? So until oil is stored in Australia, it might improve our oil security on paper, but it's going to do little for it in practice. And I think there's one other key point here, is that when you depend on something like oil, the best way to improve your security is to use less of it. So if the government really over the coming years wants to improve our oil security, one important thing it can do is to put in place policies that mean that we use less oil. So I'm thinking about improving fuel efficiency standards for cars, putting in place policies that increase the uptake of electric vehicles. These types of things in the long run will do more than anything else to improve Australian oil security.
And, gentlemen, the real sort of kicker for most people is the price at the bowser. Are the prices at the bowser going to be low for all of us in Australia for some time to come? David, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I suspect they're going to be persistently low as long as the COVID shock is kind of wreaking havoc in the oil markets. We should expect prices kind of to be down and to stay down for the short to medium term. So we're seeing even we're in the 80s in places. Some people are stations have posted even down as low in the 70s. The prices will be under a dollar for sure for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think they'll be low for some time. But before people get too excited, negative prices are unlikely to mean that next time you turn up to the petrol station, someone's going to pay you to fill up the tank. But yes, lower prices for the next little while.
Christian Downey is a research fellow at the Australian National University, and David Byrne is associate professor at Melbourne University. With China claiming success against COVID-19, Beijing has raised the prospect of easing border restrictions to allow some business travel with its Asia-Pacific neighbours. At this stage, it's unclear what will happen and what kind of business would be opened up. But there's concern too about whether we should be so reliant on China in the years ahead.
One of the questions I think businesses and governments will be asking themselves is, how many eggs do we have in one basket, in this case the China basket? We may choose to diversify our supply chain so that we don't have too many eggs in one basket, but I think we need to be clear China is and will be our major trading partner into the future.
Sir Rod Eddington, he's chairman of Infrastructure Partnerships Australia, speaking earlier this week. Well, Professor Anne-Marie Brady is a China specialist at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. She says it's time to rethink our strategic partnerships.
It's not just a health crisis. This is a political crisis. So it's not possible that it could be the same as before. Everything's going to change. And, you know, really one of the very worrying developments since we have heard about COVID-19 is not just that it was a disease that appeared in China and the Chinese government suppressed information about it and delayed dealing with it, allowing 5 million or so people to leave Wuhan, even when they knew that there was this epidemic developing, but also how the Chinese government is now trying to shift the narrative about the origins of COVID-19 and also use access to medical equipment and other supplies, which are, many of them are made in China, as a political tool over other governments. So this is one reason why it's very clear that the relationship that different countries have with China is going to change one way or other or another.
In Australia's context, China is our biggest trading partner. That's been the dominant reality for years now. How can the pandemic force a rethink of that?
Well, Australia's exports to China are 30%, but you do have other markets. And Australian diplomats have worked hard over years to spread the risk, to hedge against overdependence on one market. The challenge is that, you know, many countries are still quite protectionist. So New Zealand and Australia will be looking to set up a free trade agreement with the UK now that Brexit has passed, and trying to open up relations with the EU. So it really depends on our partner states. Are they themselves wanting to balance against China and find a way to open up to each other? And I think that there's more potential for this now than there ever has been before, because I see the signs in Europe that France and Germany, for example, and Czech Republic's another one, who have been very critical about things that China has done during COVID-19, and there does seem to be a shift. So something I've been arguing for a while is that if countries are concerned about China's foreign policy, then the best thing that they can do is support each other economically, because it's that trading relationship with China and other economic relationship with China is what holds a lot of governments back on dealing with national security concerns.
China's also in a position to sort of wake up faster. We've heard this week that talks with ASEAN countries are restarting, Beijing approaching some of the countries in the region about reopening business and diplomatic ties. Aren't countries like Australia and New Zealand going to need to engage with China more than ever because China's already starting to drive that opening up?
I always have advocated that we should continue to engage with China as much as we can, but we should set good boundaries. And we haven't been setting good boundaries on many aspects, to put it very simply, on political interference in our political systems. And because of the way in which that conversation has been couched between economic security versus national security, even to set boundaries, to set good boundaries with China has been regarded as controversial.
So how do we set those boundaries? I mean, one of the points you've been talking about is the idea of forming a new sort of COVID-safe bubble with Taiwan, New Zealand, Australia, Pacific partners. Could that work?
Well, our Foreign Minister, Winston Peters, has been talking about an Australia and New Zealand post-COVID bubble. And it makes sense. I mean, we've been closely linked. Our economies are very, very closely linked. And, of course, we've got so many family connections between Australia and New Zealand. So it's only natural that our two countries will pull together. But if you look at the Pacific countries, there are a majority of them do not have any COVID cases or have brought them under control, just like New Zealand and Australia are doing. So we will naturally be wanting to support them as much as possible, support them politically, economically, and also strategically. So that's an obvious grouping. And Taiwan has been the leader globally, have done better than any other society in managing COVID-19. And that's because they had some terrible experiences in the past, like the SARS outbreak in 2002, 2003, where they were shut out from the WHO, where they were lied to by China, and they had a lot of loss of life. And then it happened again a couple of other times too with H1N1 and MERS. So they acted fast and they've done a really good job at containing COVID-19. So I think that now is an excellent time for New Zealand and Australia to see how can we partner with Taiwan, what can we learn from Taiwan in the way in which they've been handling COVID-19, and where can we share resources.
Australia's Foreign Minister Maurice Payne led a bipartisan call in the past week for a global inquiry into the origin of the coronavirus. The government here is insisting that should be an independent review. There are countries who don't agree with this, but does that to you indicate that there is a bit more political will to head in the direction you're describing?
Yeah, I would ask if the countries who didn't want an inquiry into the origins of COVID-19, did they have a lot of debt owing to China? Because I think you may find that there are some economic reasons or other reasons why they are saying they don't want to inquire. I think given that every single country in the world is affected by COVID-19 and having their economies devastated and having, in some countries, a huge loss of life. So we do need to have a rigorous inquiry into COVID-19's origins and also track the history of how it developed from Wuhan and became a global pandemic. That's essential. And it's important that it's done by an independent authorities. It's not controlled by China and that it's not in any way politicised.
Obviously, there's been mishandling of coronavirus by a number of countries. I mean, the United States is an example, the UK. And some have argued that singling out China for criticism is xenophobic or racist. Do you share that view at all?
It's really important that when we're talking about these issues that we separate CCP government, the government of the Chinese Communist Party, the nation of China, the Chinese people living within China and the Chinese diaspora. So my concern is with the policies of the Chinese Communist Party, and it's not xenophobic to talk about a political party and your concerns about it. People talk about the Republicans or the Conservatives in the UK all the time. But it's the CCP who shuts down debate. And I have studied, one of the things that I've studied over many years is China's modernised propaganda system. One of the messages that the CCP puts out in its external propaganda in order to shut down debate is saying that any criticism of China is racist and xenophobic. We're not talking about the nation of China as such, which is a country of great contrast and beautiful scenery and amazing people. We're talking about the government and the political party behind it. And that is certainly something that should be discussed as we discuss and critique other political parties around the world.
Anne-Marie Brady, she's a China specialist at the University of Canterbury. And there's been criticism in the US too of the government's response. Its deaths from COVID-19 have surpassed 50,000. That's over a quarter of the world's total. And 26 million people have lost their jobs. That's more than the entire population of Australia. And it's figures like that that are bringing protesters onto the streets across a dozen or more states.
I just feel that there's not sufficient reason to force everyone to take away anyone's constitutional rights, even if it were as dangerous as they're saying it is.
Reopen North Carolina! If people don't go back to work, death is imminent. You can't eat, you can't live.
They've been egged on by Donald Trump, who's calling for states to be liberated from their lockdowns amid an increasingly partisan disagreement over how to restart the US economy.
These are great people. Look, they've got cabin fever. They want to get back. They want their life back. Their life was taken away from them.
David Lipson is the ABC's Washington Bureau Chief in lockdown like all of us. David, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Linda.
What can you tell us about, I guess, the mood and the concerns that are driving these protests across quite a few states now?
Well, there's a few factors at play, and it's problematic to sort of group all the protesters in to one basket. You certainly do have protesters who just believe the whole thing's a hoax, who believe it's the Democrats that are just trying to hurt Trump, who believe it's the Liberals that are trying to impinge on their freedoms. But the majority do believe that the coronavirus is a serious thing, but they just see it as not as serious as the impact on the economy here in the United States, which is massive. I mean, it is massive all around the world. But there are some other forces at play. For example, kind of elite political and business groups that are national and have been coordinating at the very least these protests. We started to notice that the messages on Facebook groups were all identical. They've been copied and pasted state to state. So they looked like there was a bit of coordination. A bit more digging by various news outlets here in the United States has shown that that is the case. A group called Freedom Works is one of the groups. They were instrumental in the rise of the Tea Party a few years back, and it looks like they're working at it again. And then sort of over the top of all of that, of course, the president himself, Donald Trump, encouraging these protests, particularly, it seems, in states that have Democrat governors. But he is responding in some ways to the protesters. In some ways, the protesters are responding to him in this kind of strange feedback loop that's going on.
So how are governors responding to this pressure from both people and the president?
Well, they're all responding very differently. For example, you've got a number of states that have now started to ease restrictions, or if not now, then in the next few days. Probably the most controversial of them is the governor of Georgia, who is going to open tattoo parlors, gyms, hairdressers, all of these kind of things that it's pretty much impossible to socially distance to do them in a way that the medical advisors in the Trump administration would advise was safe. So he's come under some criticism. But then others have just stood firm. And the vast majority of governors have just not taken much notice of the protests or the president, and they have just continued to take the best advice of their health advisors and others.
Now, the coronavirus case numbers in the US are still huge. Are there concerns that some of these attempts to open so soon are too soon, that they're going to, kick off a flare-up in cases again?
Yeah, absolutely. There are those concerns. But it's important to note that state by state, things are very different. In some of the states, in the middle of America, cases are really low. And it isn't a crazy idea to start opening up sometime in the next few weeks. If you look at a place like, New York, at least their curve is now coming down, but they may still have quite a few weeks before they are even considering opening anything up. But certainly there's this tug of war happening between the health experts, even within, Trump's inner circle, and people like the president and the president's economic advisors and some of the, Republican Party's big business donors and others who are pushing for things to open and open soon.
Is there will or capacity, David, to increase testing and contact tracing as these states reopen? Because that's going to be crucial, isn't it?
Yeah, there's absolutely will. And this is another great divide between the governors and the White House. The governors for months now have been crying out for greater testing capacity. And for most of that time, the White House and certainly the president and the vice president have been claiming there's more than enough tests. You don't need any more tests. And if you need more tests, just go and get yourself more tests. But it is more complicated than that. This is a question that comes up every single day in the White House briefings that the president is giving. And every single day he sort of bats off the testing questions and says, we've done more tests than anyone else in the world. He tells a falsehood where he claims that America has done more tests than the rest of the world combined, which is just demonstrably not true. It's clearly a sore point, and clearly one of the major factors as to why it's been so hard for the United States to get a handle on this.
Of course, this is an election year in the US. Where do you see Donald Trump going with this? Will he keep heaping on the pressure?
I think he'll just do what he does very effectively, and that is stir things up, attack his enemies, and cause as many sort of distractions as he can. And we've seen that day after day. He's still, even through the most serious threat to America in many decades, managing personally to control a lot of the narrative in the media here, because every day he comes up with some sort of new thing that outrages a lot of the media. And so, you've seen him attack the fake news media, as he calls it. We've seen him attack the World Health Organization. He's passed an immigration ban for people applying for green cards. He's pretty effective at blaming the previous administration. He is pretty effective at pointing out others that perhaps downplayed it, and blaming everyone from China to the World Health Organization for what's gone wrong here.
You mentioned the immigration move this week. What is all of this closing the US to the outside world while pushing to open up inside? What's it done for Donald Trump's campaign, do you think?
Well, I don't think it's hurt it. There are some polls out this week that suggested something like 80% of Americans were in favour of America stopping immigration at this time. It's a populist move, and it does play very much into Donald Trump's politics. It plays very much into his isolationist tendencies, and very much into his base. I mean, there were some commentators on Fox News that were criticising him because the immigration ban did not go far enough. I think whatever the case is as to whether immigration
hurts or helps America at this time, with just so many Americans unemployed, with the food lines getting longer and longer, and just desperation on the streets. I mean, I feel it here in Washington, D.C., among the homeless. It's getting more and more desperate, the feeling. So I think that immigration message resonates at a time like this, whether it's right or wrong. I don't think it's going to do the president any harm.
David Lipson, thank you very much for talking with us today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's Saturday AM for this week. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And for news every 15 minutes across the weekend, head to ABC News Radio. I'm Linda Mottram. Talk to you next Saturday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.